Good evening, everyone. It's a great pleasure for me to be back in Melbourne. Richard, you pointed out a whole series of challenges the world faces. But where else would you rather be if you're going to face those challenges? I was recently in Washington, D.C. at the IMF and G20 meetings and was sitting there with the Australian Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, and I looked around the table and I asked him, is there anyone else's job who'd rather have? And at least for me, the answer to that was no. Australia is in a remarkably good position relative to most other countries in the world, and as we deal with the problems that we have before us, I think it's really important we remember that, and I think CETA does a great job of reminding us all that there are challenges, but Australia enjoys a level of prosperity that not many other countries have. It's really an honour for me to be able to continue the tradition of the Reserve Bank Governor addressing CETA's annual dinner, so thank you very much for having me back. This is the first time in many years, though, that this annual dinner has been held against a backdrop of high inflation. For most of the past decade, the policy problem was that inflation was a bit low. Remember that? Now the problem is inflation's too high. And for the couple of years before the pandemic, inflation varied in a very narrow range in Australia, and it averaged 2.5%. An inflation rate of 7 or 8% was something that most people thought had been consigned to the history books. So the current bout of high inflation has come as a surprise to us, and I think to most in the community. I'd like to begin this evening by emphasising the importance of ensuring that this episode of high inflation is only temporary. I'll then discuss some reasons why I think inflation might be more variable over the years ahead and some of the implications of that for economic policy. And finally, I'll say a few words about the recent decisions of the Reserve Bank Board. So first, a bit of history. As you can see in my first graph, in the 1960s, the inflation rate in Australia varied between -1% and 5%, and it averaged 2%. Inflation then took off in the 1970s, and it reached a peak of nearly 18% in 1975. It stayed high through the second half of the 80s, and it was not until the early 1990s that inflation returned to low single-digit levels. And since then, through the inflation targeting regime, which started in the early 1990s, inflation has been low and it's been stable for 30 years. And just in the last year, we've seen about inflation, something that most of us had hoped had been consigned to the history books. This high inflation of the 1970s and the 1980s damaged the Australian economy and it hurt our living standards. It damaged our prosperity. It made it harder for businesses to plan and to invest, and Australians had to devote their time and their energy to protecting themselves as best they could against the ravages of inflation. The high inflation undermined our collective prosperity, it eroded people's savings, distorted resource allocation, and it increased inequality in our society. This experience also put paid to the idea that by allowing more inflation, we could have more growth and we could have more jobs. Instead, the reverse was true. The high inflation meant lower growth, it meant fewer jobs, and it meant lower real wages. I think it's really important we remember that lesson from history. Another important lesson from history is that bringing inflation back down again once it becomes entrenched in people's expectations is very costly, and it almost certainly involves a recession, perhaps a severe recession. This next graph shows the inflation and unemployment rates during the disinflation episodes in Australia and the United States after the period of high inflation. In both cases, bringing inflation back down required very high interest rates, was associated with a deep recession, and as you can see in this graph, it was associated with a rise in the unemployment rate in both countries of at least 5 percentage points. This high unemployment then persisted for years, and it left deep and enduring scars in our labour market, and it damaged the communities in both Australia and the United States. It was incredibly costly to bring inflation back down once it had become entrenched. I think it's really important to remember that. This experience lies behind the determination of the world's central banks to ensure that the current episode of high inflation is only temporary. The evidence shows that economies work best when inflation is low, and that once inflation becomes entrenched, it's very costly to the society to stamp it out. It's for these reasons that the Reserve Bank Board is resolute in its determination to return inflation to target, and we will do what's necessary to achieve that. Our central forecast is that inflation will peak later this year at around 8% and then gradually decline over the next couple of years. You can see that central forecast in this graph together with the range of uncertainty from our models. There are a number of factors that I want to highlight that lie behind this expected decline in inflation. The first is that the COVID disruptions to supply chains are being resolved. There's mounting evidence that delivery times and shipping costs are improving, and the pressure on goods prices in global markets is now abating. The second factor is that commodity prices have now stabilised, and in many cases, the commodity prices have declined back to where they were at the beginning of the year before Russia invaded Ukraine. And in time, the effect of lower commodity prices, including oil prices, will be seen in inflation in Australia. And third, the increase in interest rates both here and around the world will result in slower growth in aggregate demand. In time, less growth in aggregate demand, lower growth in aggregate demand means less pressure on capacity, and less pressure on capacity means less pressure on prices. So there is a reasonable basis to expect that inflation will come down over the next year and the year after that. Our central expectation is to be back close to 3% by the end of 2024. As always, though, there's a range of uncertainty around this outlook. Now, we can't rule out further bad news abroad that throws us off this central path. And domestically, we do need to avoid a prices-wages spiral. To date, while wages growth has picked up noticeably in parts of the economy, the aggregate outcome for wages growth in Australia is still consistent with a return of inflation to target. In contrast, you can't say that in a number of other countries. In a number of advanced economies, wages growth has picked up to rates that are not consistent at the moment with inflation returning to target. Fortunately, we're not in that position. That's best we stay where we are. So this is an area we're watching carefully. We've seen elsewhere around the world tight labour markets lead to marked pickup in wages growth. Wages growth has picked up here, and at the moment it's okay, but if it goes too much further, we'll be in a more difficult position. I now want to switch gear and discuss some longer-term changes in the global economy that are likely to affect the dynamics of inflation, central bank policy, and the way business operates here and elsewhere around the world. For the past three decades, most central banks have viewed the job of managing inflation largely through the prism of managing aggregate demand. If inflation was too low, it was because demand was too weak, and this called for monetary stimulus, lower interest rates. Conversely, if inflation was too high, it was because demand was too strong, and this called for monetary tightening, higher interest rates. So it was all about management of demand. We recognise that the supply side was important, but supply was largely treated as something that evolved fairly slowly in the background. We didn't have to worry too much about it. Our task was to manage aggregate demand with interest rates. Central banks came to this view largely because developments on the supply side were either mostly benign or favourable for managing inflation. Strong growth in international trade and deepening financial linkages across countries meant that the supply side of the global economy became very flexible. As a result, it was increasingly possible to alleviate domestic capacity pressures by tapping into global markets. In addition, rapid growth in China lowered the price of manufactured goods, and demographic trends around the world meant a large increase in the supply of labour that was engaged in the global economy. And importantly, we also largely avoided major wars that have been the source of inflation in the past. Collectively, these developments on the supply side of the global economy did make it easier for central banks to deliver low and stable inflation. Together with our monetary policy frameworks that emphasise price stability, These supply-side developments helped deliver a world in which there was very little variation in inflation from year to year. I think you saw that in my first chart. Looking forward now, the supply side looks a lot more challenging than it has been for over recent years. I think it's likely to play a more prominent role in inflation outcomes. The very recent past has provided a powerful example of this, with the supply side problems from COVID and then Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Those supply side developments have contributed to the highest inflation rate in decades. But beyond these very recent shocks, there are a number of longer term developments that are likely to create more variability in inflation than we've become used to. And I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about four of these longer term developments, and Diane mentioned a few of them before. The first is the reversal of globalization. Over recent decades, international trade increased very quickly relative to the size of the global economy. You can see that increase in that chart. Production became increasingly integrated across borders, and this lowered costs, and it made supply more flexible. This growth in international trade helped lift average living standards right around the world, and Australia was a really major beneficiary of this expansion in international trade. It was key to our collective prosperity here in Australia. Now, international trade is no longer growing faster than the global economy. New trading blocks are emerging, and there's a step back from closer integration. Unfortunately, today, barriers to trade investment are more likely to be increased rather than to be removed. This will inevitably affect both growth in living standards and the pricing of goods and services in global markets. A second important supply-side factor is demographics. Up until recent years, the working age populations of the advanced economies was increasing steadily. You can see that here. The working age populations of China and Eastern Europe, two areas which were becoming increasingly integrated in the global economy, was also increasing. The participation of women in the labour market was also on the rise in most countries. The result of these developments was a significant increase in the number of workers engaged in the global economy, and advances in technology made it easy for businesses anywhere in the world to tap into this global labour market. As you can see, the trend in the working age population has now turned, and in many countries the working age population is now declining, and this decline is projected to accelerate. The impact of this is evident in the dependency ratio. This is the ratio of younger and older people in the population to people in the 18 to 65 year group. See, these dependency ratios came down for many years. They've stabilised recently in advanced economies, but they're about to shoot very significantly higher. So the working age populations are declining, and there are more older people for the working age people to look after. This is a very big change in the global economy. It's not just being experienced in the advanced economies. It's being experienced in many emerging market economies, and China is a very good example of that. Now, this is another fundamental shift in the global economy. The third important supply-side issue that I want to talk about is climate change. As you can see in this next chart, the frequency of extreme weather and climate events has increased over recent decades. I think this trend is likely to continue. These climate events disrupt production and they affect prices. We know this all too well here in Australia with the recent terrible floods. One of the factors that are putting upward pressure on prices at the moment. But it's not just food production that's affected by extreme weather. Extreme weather also disrupts the production of commodities, and it affects the transports and logistics industries. These disruptions affect prices in global markets, and I think it's likely we'll see more such disruptions over the years ahead. The fourth supply-side factor that I wanted to highlight is the energy transition in the global economy. There is a very significant increase in investment in renewable energy as we make this transition to green energy. But at the same time, the existing capital stock that's used to produce energy is depreciating quickly. either through decommissioning or lower levels of sustaining investment. It's quite difficult to make predictions here, but it's probable that the global capital stock that's used to produce energy will come under recurring stresses in the years ahead. If so, we could expect higher and more volatile energy prices during this transition to a more renewables-based energy system. In this context, it's interesting to compare investment response in Australia to the current boom in the terms of trade. The terms of trade are our export prices relative to import prices. So to compare the investment response this time to the boom in the terms of trade a bit more than a decade ago. In the earlier boom, higher commodity prices led to a surge in investment in the resources sector. This substantially added to Australia's capital stock and our ability to produce a whole range of commodities, and we're able to supply those to both the domestic and the global market. In contrast, the investment response this time has been negligible, as you can see, and there are a few signs that firms are planning to increase supply in response to the higher prices. The reasons for this are complex, but if supply does not respond to higher prices, we'll likely have more supply constraints in the future. And more supply constraints mean more and higher and more variable prices and higher prices. So all four of these supply-side developments, deglobalisation, changing demographics, climate change, and the transition in our energy systems, are first-order issues that are likely to affect many businesses in this room. They're also likely to affect the inflation dynamics in the global economy and here in Australia. We'll see more variable inflation than we have seen over the past 30 years. This extra variability inflation can come through two channels. The first is an increase in the prevalence of supply shocks. As has been evident over the past couple of years, supply shocks can generate large and rapid change in inflation. More supply shocks mean more variable inflation than we've seen. The second channel is through the global supply curve becoming less elastic than it has been over the past decade or so. Less elastic supply means that a given shift in demand has a big effect on prices. So if the global supply curve is less elastic and we see more supply shocks, we'll see more variable inflation. If this assessment about the future operating environment is close to the mark, it has a number of implications for monetary policy. The first is that it's increasingly problematic to set a narrow range that inflation's always supposed to be within. There are limits to what we can achieve, and we are likely to have to live with more variability in inflation. The second implication is that a strong nominal anchor is even more important than ever. Without a strong nominal anchor, expectations of inflation can adjust when inflation moves away from target, and if expectations adjust, it's going to be harder to return to target. We'll get better outcomes if people are confident that when inflation does move away from target, that we will return, and it will return fairly swiftly. And the design of the monetary policy framework is really important here. In my view, it's best if the nominal anchor has a medium-term focus, not a short-term one. In this respect, the long-standing formulation of the Australian inflation target with its focus on average, over time, is appropriate. So too is the flexibility in having the medium-term target specified as a range. In our case, it's 2 to 3% on average over time. I think that's a very strong setup, particularly in a world in which inflation is going to be more variable. This is an issue, though, that's worthy of examination in the current review into the RBA, and I know the committee are looking at this issue. A third implication of more variable inflation is that the monetary policy environment's likely to be more challenging for central banks. Richard, you said the last few years are going to be challenging. I'm not sure the next decade's going to be any easier. I think it could be harder. In a world in which central banks were managing fluctuations in aggregate demand with interest rates and the supply curve was relatively flat, the monetary response to demand shocks was pretty straightforward. Life's a lot more complicated in a world of supply shocks. An adverse supply shock pushes up inflation and it pushes down output and employment. If inflation's higher, that calls for higher interest rates. But if output is lower and people lose jobs, that calls for lower interest rates. So supply shocks create this tension in the monetary policy response, and I think that we'll see that tension emerge more and more frequently over the coming decades. So I feel our job will be harder, not easier. None of these developments I've spoken about undermine our ability to achieve the inflation target on average. But I think they are likely to complicate the task of managing inflation in a narrow range. But they also have implications for other arms of economic policy. As a country, we need to do what we can to make sure that our own supply side is as flexible as possible. In a world of more frequent supply shocks, we'll be better off if there's flexibility in our labour and our product markets so that we can respond quickly and effectively to unfolding developments. I think this includes flexibility in terms of fiscal policy, and that requires a strong underlying structural budget position so fiscal policy can be used to offset these shocks when it's needed and it's appropriate to do so. And we've got further work to do to put in place a strong underlying structural budget position. But the productivity agenda is also really important here. By becoming more productive, we can lift our own ability to supply goods and services to the marketplace. This is another area where, as a nation, I think we've got work to do. As is evident in this chart, labour productivity growth has averaged a bit less than 1% a year over recent years, and that's down from the rates in previous decades when it was, as you can see, 1.2 and 2.4% in the 1990s. So productivity growth has slowed, and lower productivity growth means slower growth in real wages, slower growth in aggregate wealth, and a less prosperous society. We can't affect the international environment, some of the issues I've spoken about, but we can affect our own ability to supply goods and services. So doing what we can here to lift productivity is a really important element in securing our own prosperity. The good news here, there's no shortage of ideas on what we can do. There are many reports, including some from CETA, but also from the Productivity Commission that set out the path we should to go on. We just need to go on that path to lift productivity growth. I'd now like to turn back to the here and now and the Reserve Bank Board's recent deliberations. At our meeting in early November, we conducted a review of our experience with forward guidance about the cash rate during the pandemic, and we considered our approach going forward. That review was published last week. It's available on our website, and if you're interested, I encourage you to have a look at it. Our policy package during the pandemic included being more specific than we had been in the past about our expectations about the future path of interest rates. As part of this, we set out the conditions that needed to be met before the board would increase interest rates for the first time. And we also took the additional step of indicating the timing when we expected those conditions to be met. We adopted this approach to reinforce our commitment to doing everything that we could do at the Reserve Bank to support the economy in what was an extraordinarily difficult time. Sitting here all together in Melbourne enjoying this fabulous dinner, it's easy to forget how dire the situation was in 2020. But the Reserve Bank wanted to provide insurance to the country against the worst possible outcomes, and we adopted this approach to forward guidance as part of that policy response. Fortunately, as a country, we did avoid the worst possible outcomes. We did much better than that. In hindsight, the full insurance package that we took out wasn't needed. But sometimes that happens with insurance. You take out insurance and it's not needed and you wish you hadn't taken it out. And I think that's the world we're in at the moment. But if the worst does happen, you're pretty glad you took out the insurance. But the worst didn't happen here, and we didn't need that full insurance package. But we also had difficulties with our communication, and our review of forward guidance talks about those. In particular, the message about the expected timing of the first increase in interest rates dominated the message about the conditions under which interest rate would be increased. Indeed, in our statements were widely interpreted and reported as a commitment by me that the board would not raise rates until 2024. This meant that when we did lift interest rates in May this year, many people saw us going back on this commitment not to raise rates till 2024. And this, I think, has hurt our reputation, and we talk about this in the review that's on our website, and we're really committed to learning from this experience. Following the first increase in interest rates earlier this year, the board has returned to approach to forward guidance that it used before the pandemic. That approach is qualitative in nature, and any forward guidance is focused on the very short term. We value the flexibility in that approach, and in future we will avoid communication that focuses on the calendar or that's too specific. We are, though, strongly committed to providing information that allows people to make their own judgments about future movements in interest rates. This information includes our economic forecasts, the issues and uncertainties that the board is grappling with, and how the board is using its policy framework to make its decisions. We hope that this transparency will help you all understand how monetary policy is set, and you can form your own expectations about how interest rates are going to evolve in the future. As you would be aware, the board has increased the cash rate significantly since May this year. The cash rate currently stands at 2.85%. That's up from just 0.1% in May. We needed to remove the pandemic emergency settings, and we needed to respond to the higher inflation. We'd previously taken out an insurance policy, and insurance policy was no longer needed. And we had to move quickly, given the very significant rise in inflation. Now, we understand that many people are finding the increase in interest rates to be very difficult. It's necessary, though, to ensure that the current period of high inflation is only temporary. As I spoke about earlier, if high inflation were to persist, all Australians will pay a high price, and best we avoid it. Given our mandate for price stability and full employment, the board expects to increase interest rates further over the period ahead. We're not on a preset path, though. We have not ruled out returning to 50 basis point increases if the situation requires that, nor have we ruled out keeping interest rates unchanged for a period of time as we assess the state of the economy and the outlook for inflation. The board's priority is to return inflation to target over time. We are resolute in our determination to make sure that this happens and that this current bout of high inflation is only temporary. As we take our decisions over coming meetings, we'll be paying close attention to developments in the global economy, to the evolution of household spending, and the wage and price setting behaviour in the economy. Developments in each of these three areas will affect the pace at which inflation returns to target and whether the economy can remain on an even keel over the next couple of years. So we're going to be watching these issues very carefully over the months ahead. Thank you very much for listening, and I'd be delighted to answer some questions. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Governor. Are certainly a lot for us to think about and digest. So we're going to run a Q&A session. So you'll be able to ask questions live in the room, as well as using the Pigeonhole app, which is up on the screen now. And you can also vote for your favourite question if you'd like to do that. So I'll try to keep an eye on the app and any hands that I see. If you do wish to ask a question, just pop your hand up and some of the CEDA staff we'll come around and we'll get the mic over to you. Perhaps to start us off, Governor, I might start with an upbeat question. You talked about how lucky we are to be in Australia and that you wouldn't swap our position for anyone else's. wonder if you could talk a little bit more about why that's the case and what we need to do to make sure we stay in that position.
Thank you. I mean, the level of output in Australia is significantly above where it was before the pandemic. Think about in the United Kingdom, their current projections are they will not get back to the level of output before the pandemic until the end of 2024, by which time we'll be 5 or 6 or 7% above where we were before. So that's a big difference, and part of it's the way we manage the pandemic. The other very positive element of the Australian economy at the moment is we're at full employment. We're perhaps past full employment. Now, we haven't been able to say for 50 years that if in Australia, if you want a job, you can get one. We're not quite there, but you know, most people who want a job in Australia can get a job. Youth unemployment, the lowest it's been in many, many decades. And that's kind of a fantastic thing for the society, because people get a job, they get on the ladder of opportunity, they develop skills, and they can participate more constructively in society. So not many countries are in the same position. Labour force participation has risen a lot here. Never in before in Australian history have we seen a higher share of the population with a job than today. It's remarkable. Our terms of trade are very strong, the high commodity prices, the budget position's improved a lot, and people have got jobs. So there's a lot to like, isn't there? It's the result of, I think, our response during COVID, that both from the health side and the economic side, a lot of monetary and fiscal stimulus was delivered, and that's put us in this good position, and we're benefiting from the higher commodity prices. Australians are participating in the labour force. Now, in the UK and the US, labour force participation has declined. People have withdrawn, but Australians are participating like they've never done before. So I wouldn't want to swap our position for anyone else. Longer term, we've got very significant opportunities in renewable energy, and one imagines and hopes that we can take advantage of those over time. So the combination of our natural resources, our ingenuity, the fact that population's growing again, in the last quarter population grew as fast as it was growing before the pandemic. People want to come and live in this country, they want to work, they want to prosper, and they make the society better. So, you know, it's a pretty good place. You know, we've got problems, but I think we've got to remember that not many people in the world most people in Australia would want the position we have, and not many people would say they're in a better position than us. So we've got to remember that.
That's a good reminder for us all. One of the things that Diane touched on in her opening remarks also was the importance of resilience. And I think that's one of the things that we've learned with these unknowns that can hit us, the importance of being resilient. What do you think we need to get right, or perhaps get better in terms of our fundamentals to remain resilient in the eye of things that may be coming that we don't know about?
Well, there are a few elements to this. I think resilience requires diversification. It doesn't require closing the borders and doing everything here. That will be, in the end, that would be a bad step. Some things we've got to do here, but the best response to these problems with resilience is diversify, not close the borders. I think we've, as I said in my prepared remarks, we've got to return to the productivity agenda. And we've got to make sure that our economy remains flexible. Because the environment that I was sketching was a world where there's more shocks. And in a world of shocks, you need flexibility. If you have a rigid economy where labour and capital cannot move freely, the shocks are much more damaging. So we've got to be strategic about keeping flexibility in the economy and re-energising the productivity agenda. I know the government is focused on that.
Speaking of shocks, you talked about the inflation target and that it is a narrow target, but you'll expect there'll be some variability outside that. Does that provide a communication challenge for the RBA in talking to the economy about that's our target, but expect variation?
I mean, it's really tough. Now, what we want people to understand that over time, inflation in Australia will average 2 point something, but it will vary. You know, I don't know how low it'll go and how, but it will vary around that. And when it varies, that isn't a policy failure. That is a result of the world we live in. But when it does vary, I want you all to be very confident that we will take the action that's necessary to get it to come back. And our job will be easier if people believe us. This is why I highlighted the possibility of a wage price spiral here, because if you don't believe that inflation is going to come back to 2 or 3%, then you'd naturally want to have much bigger wage rises and to have those baked in. But if you're confident that inflation is going to come back to 2 point something, then it's easier to ride through these swings in inflation. So it's going to, I think it will be more difficult. Now, we talked about, up until maybe 5 or 6 years ago, the great moderation. You know, when Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke, they were talking about the great moderation. Everything seemed stable and you know, there were small fluctuations in aggregate demand, but they weren't that big, were they?
It's pretty boring. It's, yeah.
Well, I didn't find it boring, but it was, I mean, it wasn't, you know, central banks took a lot of the credit for it and say we were kind of manage this. Well, the truth was our job was a lot easier. And I think it's going to become harder.
Mm. Speaking of wage price spiral, there was an article today in the Fin Review from Craig Emerson, and he wrote that in his view, what we're seeing now is something closer to post-1940s supply-side inflation issues. Because of supply-side issues, pressure on inflation, and therefore he was saying that perhaps there isn't as much need for a further increase, certainly not in December, because we need to see how that plays out and perhaps the risk of wage price spiral is being overstated. I just wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, certainly the supply side things have pushed prices up, and now that they are rectifying. So I think we will see some of the price pressures that you've experienced in your businesses start to dissipate. Many prices in global markets have come down and the supply side is freeing up and delivery time is shortening. So that is going to help, and that will bring inflation down. The issue that many central banks have been worried about, and I'd include us on this, that this period of high inflation leads the workforce to say, well, inflation's high, I need full compensation for that. And let's say we all accepted the idea, which there's a natural appeal to this, inflation's 7%, I should be compensated for that in my wages. If that were to happen, what do you think inflation would be next year? 7% plus or minus. And then we've got to get compensated for that? 7%, 7%. And this is what happened in the 70s and 80s, and as I talked about, that turned out to be a disaster. So I know it's very difficult for people to accept the idea that wages don't rise with inflation, and people are experiencing a claim real wages. That's tough. The alternative, though, is more difficult. And if we can ride through this period with wages growth staying kind of broadly in the current range, maybe a bit higher, but broadly in that range, and the supply side problems resolve, inflation will come down and it can be painless, relatively. But if we all buy into the idea that wages have to go up to compensate people for inflation, it will be painful. So best avoid that.
A couple of questions off the app before I head out of the back. One of the questions that has come through, it's been suggested that climate change and net zero should be made two of the RBA's top economic goals. Would you support such a change to the RBA's charter?
Well, there's certainly things we think a lot about, and I talked a bit about tonight, but you know, I set the short-term interest rate. But as much as I wish that could help solve climate change, it can't. So I really struggle, even if that was kind of if it was added to our charter, what, you know, what could mean in practice. But what we need to do is to understand how it's affecting the economy, investment decisions, pricing decisions, and inflation. So you know, we're spending a lot of time and resources understanding those things. But I think it would be a mistake to add that to our objectives because we cannot do anything about it.
We talked about this earlier in the evening, but there's a question here regarding there are a large number of households rolling off fixed rates next year. How will you be factoring equity into decision making?
Yeah, that's a good question, one we've thought about a lot as well. we all know that monetary policy operates with a lag. All our models say that when we tap the interest rate break, the maximum effect on output is 18 months to 2 years later. So we operate with a lag. I think at the moment it's quite likely the lag is going to be a bit longer than it normally would be. And that complicates our task as well. And I say that for a few reasons. The first is over the past couple of years, Australians saved an extra $250 billion over what they would normally save in a 2 year period. $250 billion, that's a lot of money. So that's sitting there and that's supporting consumption. A second thing we saw during the pandemic was people take out fixed rate loans. In Australia in the past, maybe 10% of the population would take out a fixed rate loan. Well, during the pandemic, it got to 50%. So a lot of people took out fixed rate loans, so they are not yet paying the higher interest rates, but they will start paying them next year. It doesn't give me advice on monetary policy, so I'm not going to give it advice on fiscal policy. But I think that there's a serious point here, though, that in a world where there's a lot of shocks, we need fiscal and monetary policy to have the flexibility to respond to that. And we will only have the flexibility with fiscal policy if the structural budget position is sound. We saw that going into both the global financial crisis and the pandemic. Because of two or three decades of good fiscal policy in Australia, we had a very sound structural budget position. And we're able to use the public balance sheet to shield the public from very large shocks. And I know it's controversial, but I think that was the right thing to do. To use the public balance sheet to help the private balance sheets in a very difficult period. But you can only do that if the public balance sheet is in a good position. And we've got work to do. As you say, the public are very desirous of services provided by the government. I think aged care, education, training, fantastic health care. So, we all want those things. We just need to work out how to pay for them. And my view is the best way to do it is to return to productivity growth to make sure the pie is bigger, because if the pie is bigger, we can afford these things. But if you're dealing with a small pie, it's very hard. So that's the challenge that lies before the political class, and I think us as a society, how do we align up our desire for government services with our lack of desire to pay for them? We have to confront that.
A slightly related question that's come through in relation to infrastructure projects and whether the high government expenditure, or how much has the high government expenditure contributed to our 8% inflationary environment?
Well, it would have, I mean, it's contributed a bit, but I don't think that's the main factor. The main factor underlying the high inflation is COVID, Russia, and the fact that we took out this insurance policy that in the end we didn't fully need. When you look at the accumulation of the fiscal support and the monetary support, it was extraordinary. We thought it was the right thing to do at the time, and given what I knew at the time, I still think it was the right thing to do. But in hindsight, we took out too much insurance. And so people have more money and they're spending it. And that's why we've really got high inflation. And the extra spending that's come from infrastructure is adding to it, but it's not the primary cause here. It's the insurance policy, Russia, and supply problems in COVID.
Thank you. Another question from the audience.
Thank you. Maria Jockel, BDO Global Immigration Services. Thank you for your presentation and for your overview. You've made a number of comments which enlivened my desire to ask this question. We're aware of the current state of affairs, both globally and in Australia. You've also touched upon the working age population and labour productivity and other issues and their impact on the economy, etc. I'd like you to comment on what is the impact of the fact that Australia as a nation of immigrants has always relied on a robust immigration policy as an economic and population policy. We are an ageing population. We have got 3.4% unemployment, a 50-year historic low. If I may say so respectfully, I would have expected you to say more about the impact of that, particularly in the current environment when we've reopened our borders. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, there are a number of ways of coming at this. The first way is from a longer-term perspective. In the last census, I think 28% of Australians were born overseas. 28% of us were born overseas. And another 20% have one parent who was born overseas. So 48% of us, either immigrants ourselves or kind of a child of an immigrant. And no other Western country can report figures anywhere like that. So we are a great immigrant country. People come here to study, to improve their lives, to work, to participate, to build a better future for them and their children. So it's one of our, I think it's one of Australia's core strengths. It certainly helps GDP growth because there are more people, but it brings a dynamism to our society and an energy that we otherwise wouldn't have. So I think it's kind of incredibly important, and it's one of the things we should celebrate. It also means our demographics are better than many other Western countries because the average age of immigrants is lower than the average age of people already here. So we've become a bit younger. Eventually that catches up with us, but we've got a dynamism from immigration. You feel this in Melbourne and in Sydney as well. So that's a longer term perspective. In the short term, the fact that the borders are open allows businesses to hire workers where the skills are in short supply. And that will take some of the pressure out of the labour market, which I think is positive. And it will also allow firms to undertake investments that they mightn't otherwise do. In the last couple of years, I spoke to a lot of businesses saying, well, they really want to invest, but they can't get the person, the technician to come from overseas, or there's a shortage of people with specialist skills. The borders are now open and those specialist skills can come in, and that's relieving bottlenecks in the economy. That's going to help us as well. But I don't think the low unemployment, is my last point, the low unemployment is not because we closed the borders. Now, because lots of countries have fairly low unemployment at the moment, and some countries still had their borders open, others didn't. We've got low unemployment because we had very large fiscal and monetary response. And I think our firms needed extra workers to help with the pandemic. But a strong lesson for me for the last couple of years is that a very, very deliberate monetary and fiscal response can generate lower unemployment. It worked. And more Australians today have a job than ever before. And almost everyone in the country who wants a job can find a job. Mightn't be the job they want, but we haven't been able to say that for 50 years. For the last 50 years, a problem in our country is that people who wanted jobs couldn't find them. And that's not because we closed the borders, it's because of the policy response. Yeah. Thank you for that question.
There was a question coming through on the app about on that sort of related to that topic, and given that wages have not kept pace with productivity growth during the past decade, what incentive do working Australians have to further increase their productivity?
What incentive does an individual? I don't know, but we should have a collective incentive because we know that at the end of the day, the driver of growth in real wages is productivity. We can only pay ourselves more in real terms if we get better at doing stuff. So that's the underlying incentive, and if we have strong productivity growth, then the pie, the fiscal pie, is bigger, and we can afford all these wonderful things the public want from government. So the pie will be bigger, we'll enjoy higher real wages, and the value of our real assets will be higher as well, because their income-generating potential is higher. So that's the incentive we should all have, and our society has to work out how to share the benefits of that productivity growth. That's been the problem, I think, of the last decade or so, that those benefits weren't being shared sufficiently equally, and that was creating disillusionment. But it shouldn't make us doubt the benefits of productivity growth. If we can't get better at doing stuff, then we're not going to pay ourselves more. The value of our assets won't go up, and we won't have the money to pay for all the goodies. So we've got to get better at doing stuff, haven't we?
Thank you. I think time for one last question from the audience. Thank you.
Hi, Dr. Lowe. John Jury from Smart Company. Two questions. Firstly, you've warned about the dangers of wages going up too quickly. In another place, the Prime Minister's talking about how we need to get higher wages. Who wins that argument? Secondly, You talk like your brethren about we need higher productivity growth. I'd be interested from you three specific things we can do to lift productivity growth in Australia.
Oh, good questions. Well, I don't think there is an argument here that has to be won or lost. I mean, we both share the vision of stronger growth in real incomes for people. I think the Prime Minister and the Treasurer have both spoken about the need to have stronger growth in real incomes, and I share that objective as well. Now, for many years, probably at previous CETA speeches, I bemoaned the low wages growth because it was too low, and I thought it was problematic, and the benefits of productivity growth weren't being sufficiently equally shared. We've just got to be careful we don't jump way to the other side here. I don't think we will, but I'm just cautioning people, as I did in my earlier remarks, that if we do, we'll have problems. But we've got to make sure that real wages rise. And if we accept the idea that nominal wages have to match inflation, then that's a path to higher inflation, higher unemployment, and worse real wages. So that you've heard me on that. The specific things on productivity, again, I don't like providing specific advice to government because they don't provide advice to me, as they shouldn't. But you know, I have, in my spare time, read those endless reports from the OECD, the IMF, the Productivity Commission, the New South Wales Productivity Commission. I think I had one today about skills and training. So there's a long list of things at a very broad level. People point out the taxation system needs further reform. The combination of the taxes on effort, wages and consumption and land. I don't think many people would say that's optimal. The way our society is responding to the digital innovation and the opportunities there, we need further training. I don't know, presumably many businesses like the Reserve Bank, we can't find the people to do the stuff. So we need to invest more in our people and the digital economy. And the third thing I would highlight is the selection of infrastructure projects, the way we manage the construction costs and the way we price infrastructure. And the fourth thing would be the university system to make sure that that's fit for purpose. So I don't want to kind of have specific policy, advance specific policy proposals in each of those areas. That's not my area. But I think there are the areas to look at. And you can look at all those reports. Lots of good ideas. It's just hard to, I mean, the trouble is every one of those good ideas is contested. So we need business and the community to help the government work through those issues, because the good news is there's lots of things we can do. We've just got to do it.
Very last question. You're in charge of banknotes. This $5 note, is this a collector's item with a head of state on it, do you think? Will we see another one?
Well, I don't know. There are a lot of $5 notes out there, but I like sharing this statistic on $100 notes. There are 18 $100 notes out there for every person in the country. 18. If I asked everyone to empty the wallet and purse out, we probably wouldn't find 18 in this room. I don't know. But so there's a lot of $100 notes out there, and despite banknotes not being used very much for day-to-day transactions, a lot of people have got them at home, under the bed, in the cupboard. I don't know. And then the $5 note...
Well, 48% of people are migrants, so I think that's where I'd start.
Yeah, man.
Well, including me.
But the $5 note... we've had at least the monarch on one of our notes since 1923, and up until 1953, the monarch was on all our notes. So there's a long tradition of having the monarch on our notes. We know it's... an issue that the public and the political class have a strong interest in. And while it's ultimately the Reserve Bank's decision, the design of the banknotes, I thought it wise to consult the government to hear their view on what the new $5 note, or whether the new $5 note should have the monarch on. So I'm waiting to hear back. If they were to elect, if they said, well, we don't think it's appropriate anymore. If they said that, I'm not saying they will, then we would explore an Indigenous design. But if the government of Australia says we think it's the right thing for Australia to have a monarch on one of our notes, then we'll add King Charles' portrait.
Thank you, Governor. I've gone over time. I'd like to invite Cameron Holland, the Chief Executive Officer of Ryman Healthcare, to come up to thank the Governor. Thank you.